From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, Russia is on the wrong side of history. The latest condemnation from President Obama over Moscow's military occupation of Crimea.
We are examining a whole series of steps, economic, diplomatic, that will isolate Russia.
We're in South Africa, where the murder trial of Olympic star Oscar Pistorius gets underway. And we find out why last night's Oscars have been called the most diverse in history.
Those of us in the industry who are still foolishly clinging to the idea that female films with women at the centre are niche experiences, they are not. Audiences want to see them, and in fact, they earn money.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Nina Maria Potts for the latest world news. U.S. President Barack Obama is accusing Russia of being on the wrong side of history after its invasion of Ukraine. An emergency meeting of NATO is to take place on Tuesday to discuss Western reprisals to Russia's military moves in the Crimean Peninsula. From Washington, Simon Marks reports.
The NATO meeting was requested by Poland and is the latest indication that the Western alliance is hardening its response to Russia's aggression. At the White House, flanked by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, President Obama again demanded a Russian withdrawal.
I think the strong condemnation that it's received from countries around the world indicates the degree to which Russia's on the wrong side of history on this.
The president vowed to unveil a series of moves that he says will isolate Russia, but Russian forces are digging in, Vladimir Putin rewriting history, whichever side of it he's on. Simon Marks, Washington.
Calls are growing for the U.S. to take military steps to demonstrate its backing of Ukraine's independence. Former Republican presidential candidate Senator John McCain told an audience in Washington that the Obama administration should be looking at a broader range of options.
Why do we care? Because this is the ultimate result of a feckless foreign policy where nobody believes in America's strength anymore.
British Prime Minister David Cameron has chaired a meeting of the country's National Security Council to discuss the crisis in Ukraine. Mr. Cameron told reporters that the West may need to adopt a tougher response.
We shall have to bring to bear diplomatic, political, economic and other pressures in order to make this point. That is the very clear message the whole world needs to send to the Russian government.
Paralympic athlete Oscar Pistorius has pleaded not guilty to all charges, including a murder charge, on day one of his high-profile trial in the Pretoria High Court in South Africa. Pistorius stands accused of intentionally killing his girlfriend, Reva Steenkamp, in February last year, but he claims he mistook her for an intruder. A state witness has described as blood-curdling the scream she heard from a woman shortly before gunshots rang out on the night. But the defense team has offered a different version. Gary Alfonso reports.
Both the prosecution and the Pistorius defense team got down to their core arguments on day one of this high-profile trial. State prosecutor Kerry Nell read out the murder charge and three gun charges. Pistorius pleaded not guilty to all of them. Witness number 80 was the first called by the state. A neighbor from a house 177 meters away, Michelle Berger, testified she heard blood-curdling screams from a woman and four gunshots. The defense team argued her husband heard 4 to 6 shots and suggested it was Pistorius screaming hysterically that she heard, as well as him breaking down the door with a cricket bat.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. U.S. President Barack Obama is using a visit by Benjamin Netanyahu to Washington to apply pressure on the Israeli prime minister to push forward towards a peace deal. In an interview before the meeting, the U.S. leader has been quoting a famous saying by a renowned Jewish philosopher, Rabbi Hillel, "If not now, when?" The U.S. is brokering peace negotiations, which are scheduled to be wrapped up in April. Our correspondent in Washington, Daniel Rentschler, says President Obama is trying to increase pressure on the Israelis to make more concessions to the Palestinians.
Before the meeting with Prime Minister Netanyahu, President Obama's given a rather blunt interview in which he talked about the continuing aggressive settlement building, in his words, which he said could risk further international isolation, which the Americans would not be able to defend the Israelis against in the international community. The Israelis are saying that they think the Iranians are just buying time for more weaponization of their nuclear stockpile, whilst the Americans are prepared to give the Iranians a chance.
Three suspects have been arrested in connection with Saturday's deadly stabbing spree at a train station in China's southwestern city of Kunming, according to state officials. 28 people were killed Saturday after eight assailants used knives and daggers against commuters. Police shot and killed four suspects at the scene and arrested another. Chinese officials say Muslim separatists are responsible for the attack. Freelance journalist Primrose Riordan is in Beijing.
Eight assailants burst into the railway ticket office and dressed in black and just start slashing randomly a crowd of commuters. Enormous long knives that randomly peep at, you know, women, children, anyone on the scene. And 29 people have ended up killed so far.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Nina Maria Potts reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Russia is on the wrong side of history and has violated international law. The words of President Obama earlier in reaction to Moscow's growing military role in the unrest in Ukraine, adding that Russia cannot act with impunity. This came after Russia denied earlier reports it had threatened Ukraine with an ultimatum to surrender Crimea. US Secretary John Kerry, meanwhile, is heading for Ukraine amid attempts from NATO and the international community to convince Moscow to pull its troops out of the peninsula. The crisis also saw $60 million wiped from the Russian stock market on Monday alone. Earlier, I discussed events with FSN's correspondent in Crimea, Tom Barton.
Rallies are continuing here in Simferopol, the capital, the regional capital of Crimea, with so-called self-defense battalions having been set up and patrolling the city, and a very aggressive atmosphere here with many foreigners, journalists, and generally people walking about their business being questioned about which side they're on, about who they support in this very tense situation.
We're seeing images of armed forces, reportedly pro-Russian, taking up strategic positions across that region. But the atmosphere also appears, you know, from the footage we've seen, to be relatively calm.
Well, of those garrisons that there are in Crimea still, there's two main garrisons and a naval garrison in Sevastopol as well. Of those troops, it has been said more than once that the Ukrainian troops remain there, saying they have pledged an oath to protect Ukraine, to fight for Ukraine. They want a united Ukraine, and they will not surrender without a fight. That is their job. We understand that those forces do have quite an arsenal potentially available to them. However, they are hugely outnumbered by Russian forces, and so it's thought that if an attack was launched, it may be something of a bloodbath.
Tom, can you explain how Russia has justified these actions that have been roundly internationally condemned as aggressive and widely held to be unacceptable?
Various Russian officials have been saying that they are justified in their deployment of troops to try and protect ethnic Russians here. That's about 60% of the population in Crimea. And also protesters on the ground here, pro-Russian protesters and Russian officials, are saying that the government in Kiev are an illegitimate government, that they are nationalists and fascists, an awful lot of nasty historical baggage being dragged up from, especially from the Second World War, where some Ukrainians decided that they had been so persecuted by Stalin's communists that they decided to join German forces when they invaded the Soviet Union. So a lot of vitriol coming out of pro-Russian protests here in Crimea, and an enormous media storm in Russia to try and convince Russians and generally to try and justify what they argue is Russia protecting ethnic Russians in Ukraine.
The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, he has said that Russian have taken this course of military action in order to defend ethnic Russian citizens and uphold basic human rights.
Well, as various diplomats and politicians have pointed out, protect ethnic Russians in Ukraine from what? They have said that there is only a few nationalists in Kiev. It's a small part of the so-called Maidan movement that eventually toppled the Russian-backed president Viktor Yanukovych. and that all communities in Crimea certainly have lived in harmony, really, since the end of the Soviet Union. There are Crimean Tatars here and ethnic Ukrainians who support Kiev rather than Moscow, but that has really not been a problem until now, and this wave of sudden agitation by certain groups to say that essentially all those in Kiev are fascists, dredging up old memories and hatreds in the region. These politicians, both in Kiev and in the international community, have said quite plainly that this is just a trumped-up excuse by Moscow to try and grab territory from Ukraine after they lost essentially their horse in the race for the rule of Ukraine, which was Viktor Yanukovych.
Tom Barton in Crimea. Well, here in Washington, although the White House says it's rallying allies and looking to hit Russia where it hurts, many on Capitol Hill have been calling for the Obama administration to take a tougher line with Moscow over the crisis in Ukraine. Earlier, FSN's Lorna Shadegg spoke to András Simonyi, former Hungarian ambassador to the US and managing director of the Center for Transatlantic Relations at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. And she began by asking whether he agreed with those in Washington who say the Obama administration's foreign policy isn't realistic.
We have gotten ourselves into a situation which probably could have been avoided with a tougher, stronger stance on Russia. And think tanks like ours have been warning about a resurgent Russia, a Russia that wants to assert itself in, especially in Eastern Europe, for a long time.
How then would you have advised the Obama administration to act differently? You say a tougher stance. What do you mean exactly by that?
I mean, you don't draw red lines and then turn them into pink lines and then turn them into no lines at all. What you have to do is you have to state very clearly in an early conversation, this is as far as you can go and no further, and then state very clearly what the consequences will be. Acting when there is already fire, all you can do is put out the fire. I think it's a much better, much sounder policy to try and prevent the fire. But let me tell you this, the things that are happening in the Ukraine and the situation in the Ukraine cannot be blamed on the United States alone. It's, I think, the West, the European Union, all have their share of the, if you want, the blame, why we ended up like this. The bottom line is, today we need to figure out what to do now. And on this, U.S. leadership is absolutely crucial.
Secretary of State Kerry is going to Kiev tomorrow in order to take that leadership forward. What does he need to do then?
Well, I think they're doing the right thing. I think he's doing the right thing. He has to go there. It does make a difference where you are giving your message. It's one thing to make statements in Washington, but it's extremely important that he will be confirming those messages. But then I do think we need to follow up on this. There are a couple of other things that we might want to do and spell it out loud and clear to the Russians so that they understand.
And what are those things then that need to be done to follow up?
Well, first of all, I think we have to rethink our Russia policy. Unfortunately, Russia proved not to be the partner that we were hoping for. We must figure out a way to take steps that will make Russia understand that in a globalized world, this behavior is unacceptable. For example, Europe and America will have to rethink transatlantic energy policies. This is absolutely crucial. Europe is too dependent on Russian gas. I think we should move away from this. This could cost Russia very, very dearly. Another thing is, I wonder if Russia, a country that is bullying smaller countries that have a much weaker defense, should be actually on the G8. Big question. I think the first steps to send a message on that have been taken. Maybe we should walk the whole mile.
Do you think that the US has shown sufficient leadership and has sufficient credibility, foreign policy-wise, to work with Europeans as you've just advocated?
Russia has had some considerable successes in driving a wedge between the United States and Europe. It is stoking anti-American sentiments, which is an old, rusty tool in the political toolbox of Russia and previously the Soviet Union. Let us prove that those tools are really rusted. We don't need them. We can't use them. Mr. Putin, that's outdated. Move on.
former Hungarian ambassador to the US Andras Simonyi. And as the standoff continues between the US and Russia over Ukraine, lawmakers and political analysts here in the US have taken to the airwaves and social media to criticise President Obama's handling of the situation, many demanding the White House, State Department and Congress all take stronger economic and diplomatic action to counter the government of Vladimir Putin and assist the newly installed government in Ukraine. Our correspondent Alice Olstein has reaction from Capitol Hill.
The U.S. response to the conflict in the Ukraine developed rapidly over the day Monday, but the White House canceled its press briefing and Congress canceled its planned session due to less than a foot of snow. But both supporters and critics of President Obama's handling so far have been vocal over the last 48 hours. Secretary of State John Kerry, who leaves this evening for the Ukraine, worked the Sunday talk shows in defense of the president, listing several actions the U.S. could take against Russia on NBC's Meet the Press.
There is no way to start with that if Russia persists in this, that the G8 countries are going to assemble in Sochi. That's a starter. But there's much more than that. Russia has major investment and trade needs and desires. I think there's a unified view by all of the foreign ministers I talked with yesterday, all of the G8 and more, that they're simply going to isolate Russia, that they're not going to engage with Russia in a normal business as usual manner. There could even be, ultimately, asset freezes, visa bans. There could be certainly a disruption of any of the normal trade routine. There could be business drawback on investment in the country. The ruble is already going down and feeling the impact of this. And this is not, the reason for this, David, is because you just don't invade another country on phony pretext in order to assert your interests.
As Kerry and others push for economic sticks against Russia, others are calling for economic carrots for the Ukraine, whose economy is currently in shambles. Illinois Democrat Dick Durbin said the U.S. should use its influence in international bodies like the United Nations and International Monetary Fund to lend money and political support to the newly installed government.
What the Senate should do quickly is a resolution condemning what Putin has done. Second, saying that if Ukraine will stand up for real reform, that we're going to back them through the IMF, and making it clear to our allies in NATO that that alliance is strong, and neighbors of Russia that we are going to do everything in our power to discourage further aggression by Putin.
At the urging of the G7, the U.S. and six other richest nations in the world, the International Monetary Fund announced Monday that it will begin negotiating a bailout for the Ukraine to the tune of some $15 billion. There will be strings attached, possibly the privatization of natural resources and deep cuts to social welfare programs, but the new Ukrainian government said they will do whatever it takes. A team from the IMF will land in the Ukraine Tuesday to assess the state of the country's finances and set the terms for a bailout. But even those who support these steps, including Arizona Republican John McCain, continue to criticize President Obama. In a speech Monday at the annual summit of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, he suggested how the U.S. government could better stand up to Russia.
The most powerful and biggest and strongest nation in the world should have plenty of options. And those options are many, ranging from identifying these kleptocrats, these corruption people, and the people that ordered this and the Magnitsky Act. Thank God for the Magnitsky Act. We could expand it and identify those people, and it would be their last trip to Las Vegas. So we can enact our economic sanctions. We can, there's a broad array of options that we have. Why do we care? Because this is the ultimate result of a feckless foreign policy where nobody believes in America's strength anymore.
McCain's Republican colleagues in Congress have been airing similar criticisms. Michigan's Mike Rogers, chair of the House Intelligence Committee, told Fox News Sunday that Russia is running circles around the Obama administration on messaging and strategy, while Republican Majority Leader Eric Cantor put out a statement saying, "We need an America that leads." Cantor cited a scathing op-ed by the editorial board of the Washington Post, which slammed the president's foreign policy as one based on fantasy and called for more global engagement. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
This is FSN Reports. Now, the murder trial of South African Paralympic gold medalist Oscar Pistorius got underway in Pretoria on Monday. The first state witness testified that she and her husband, who lived near the athlete's home, were woken by loud screams. Michelle Berger told the court that they also heard four gunshots on the night Mr. Pistorius is accused of intentionally shooting and killing his girlfriend, Reva Steenkamp. Earlier, I discussed the opening day's events with our South Africa correspondent, Gary Alfonso.
Perhaps the first significant issue in court was the delay of 90 minutes of the Oscar Pistorius trial because a translator did not want to be part of the international broadcast. And of course, this is the first case in South Africa where television cameras and audio microphones have been allowed. And the translator did not want to be part of that. And that delayed proceedings by about 90 minutes. But when the court case eventually got going, The charges were read to Pistorius, and four charges, the first one being a murder charge, and the three others gun-related charges in which he discharged a firearm and the ownership of ammunition, which are not really related to the crime itself. And he basically pleaded not guilty to all four charges, and that got the ball rolling very quickly. And the first thing to happen after that is the fact that the state prosecution then, without any opening remark, simply called their first state witness. And it was witness number 80 on their list. It was a woman called Michelle Berger, who was was a neighbor who lived 177 meters away. That's about 210 yards away from the Pistorius home, where obviously the shooting happened on the night of February 14th, 2013, just more than a year ago. So she was the first witness, and the fact that Gerry Nel, who is the state prosecutor, called her in first is because her testimony basically centered on the testimony that she heard a woman scream, and she described the screams as blood-curdling, and then four shots ringing out, and that statement as was read in court, and she corroborating that, basically set the tone for what's going to be a serious battle in court.
There has been a scrum of international interest around this trial. As you said, parts of it being televised. That's a first for the South African justice system. Why have they taken this decision?
South Africa does not have a jury system. It has a system that was abolished in 19... The jury system was abolished in 1964 because the apartheid government did not want ordinary citizens to second-guess the master authorities. So at the moment, the only voice in a court is that of a judge. But the system has somewhat evolved since 1994. And the judge, Judge Tokozile Masipa, is a woman, and she's in charge of these court proceedings, but she has two assessors assisting her. And the decision by the National Prosecuting Authority to open up this court case is perhaps a sign that the judiciary sees the transformation from within as a very important part of transforming the judiciary, which still many people still feel have very much a lot of apartheid roots, and perhaps tentacles of apartheid kind of justice still sitting in it, with that singular sort of authoritarian legal minds making decisions and taking decisions at the end of the day. And I think a very clear sign of things to come, and also showing the international media community and also the international audiences that South Africa's legal system is one that can work for all people.
Let's talk about the role that social media has played already, because for many people, this trial began long before court proceedings opened today.
Absolutely. And the media opinion and people sitting in the courtroom tweeting from there a tweet a minute, it's probably set a new record. And it's funny that the word Oscar has created two Twitter records in the past 24 hours across the globe. But in this case, the Oscar Pistorius trial is setting new rules in the way in which media organizations basically display news, for that matter. And if you think of it, 300 media organizations have been accredited to cover this. All the top international television channels have been accredited to cover it. And Twitter is by far thumping them all by as far as disseminating information through their own brands, but basically as a platform. So the and then from the Oscar Pistorius perspective themselves, involves creating this public relations arena in which they want to give their own view of events is obviously a part of the new world in which you have to manage your own reputation.
Gary Alfonso in Pretoria, South Africa. Now to Hollywood, where Gravity and 12 Years a Slave shared the Oscar spoils.
This is the most important legacy of Solomon Northup. I dedicate this award to all the people who have endured slavery and the 21 million people who still suffer slavery today.
Steve McQueen there, the first black director to win Best Picture in 86 years of Oscar history for his film 12 Years a Slave. In another first, Alfonso Cuarón became the first Latino to win Best Director for Gravity. And with an openly gay host in Ellen DeGeneres, this year's Academy Awards have been dubbed the most diverse ever. FSN's Kate Fisher is in Hollywood, and I began by asking her what made this year's ceremony different.
Yes, this year's Oscars did feel as though there'd been something of a makeover. For a long time, many people have thought that the Academy has seemed like it's really stuck in the past. For example, the LA Times has recently reported that of its 6,000 members, overwhelmingly, most of them are older white men. But last night's ceremony was presented by an openly gay woman, and two of the biggest winners were two big firsts for the Academy Awards. The first black director, Steve McQueen, to win Best Picture, and the first Latino director, Alfonso Cuarón, took that gong for his film Gravity. 12 Years a Slave, of course, tackling a big and difficult subject which isn't often seen in films, and not just winning that Oscar for Steve McQueen, but also for John Ridley for his best adapted screenplay. And he becomes only the second black writer to win in that category. And also, many of the members of the film were telling the press yesterday that Solomon Northup's memoirs are to become mandatory reading in high schools in America, which is something that they were all pushing for.
And Kate, diversity was also very much evident in the range of stories that these films were telling.
Yeah, just look at the winners last night. You had slavery, outer space, the struggle against AIDS in the mid-80s in Dallas Buyers Club. And that film was actually turned down by Hollywood producers 100 times. Yet last night it won 3 Oscars. Also, women in films was a big theme last night. Gravity, the biggest winner of the night with 7 awards, while Sandra Bullock was at the centre of that film. And Cate Blanchett, another actress who basically carried a film in Woody Allen's Blue Jasmine, she won the Oscar for Best Actress. And in her speech, she used it really to trumpet how more films centred around women should be made.
Those of us in the industry who are still foolishly clinging to the idea that female films with women at the centre are niche experiences. They are not. Audiences want to see them, and in fact, they earn money. So...
That was Cate Blanchett accepting her Oscar last night for Best Actress. Well, now, with the first black woman in charge of the Academy in Cheryl Boone Isaacs, perhaps this year's Oscars may signal the start of a more diverse movie industry.
FSN's Kate Fisher reporting from Hollywood. And that's the Monday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of the programme by emailing us, reports@featurestory.com. And you can always follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. And coming up on Tuesday, we'll have the latest from Crimea, Moscow and Washington as the Ukrainian crisis continues. That's Tuesday. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside producer Simon Marks and Nina Maria Potts on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.